Let me add my welcome to Andrew. It's nice to see some new faces today. My name's also Andrew, and I'm going to be preaching from this next part of John's Gospel. So please turn back to page 898. And maybe you just thought that song we sung was a bit more gushy than you would be used to. Saying that Jesus is fairer than beautiful things and stars in the sky and meadows and things. And I don't normally express myself like this. But this lady in our chapter certainly would have described her devotion to Jesus, I think, just like that. John chapter 12, verse 1. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus therefore came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they gave a dinner for him there. Martha served, and Lazarus was one of those reclining with him at the table. Mary therefore took a pound of expensive ointment made from pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of the disciples, he who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief, and having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Jesus said, "Leave her alone, so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For the poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me." When the large crowd of the Jews learned that Jesus was there, they came, not only on account of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to put Lazarus to death as well, because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and believing in Jesus. Please keep that in front of you. And also, you'll find an outline in the middle of the service sheet that will just help you with where we're going. We're going to take as our theme today the substitution of Jesus for sinners like you and me. It's a great doctrine of the Christian church that Christians have believed throughout the last 2,000 years, that when Jesus died on the cross, it was a swap. We ought to have died on the cross, receiving God's punishment and judgment for our sin. But instead, Jesus died on the cross. He died, and we lived. It was a swap. Sometimes it's known as the doctrine of penal substitution. The word penal comes from the word penalty, and the word substitution just means swap. It was a penalty swap. Now, that's something that we believe at Grace Church Greenwich. It's something the Church of England historically has always believed. It's something Christians all over the world actually historically have always believed. But it's become a very unpopular doctrine. And it's been under attack in recent years from all different quarters. So, for example, atheists attack this idea that Jesus would be punished instead of us. Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, says, "I have described atonement, the central doctrine of Christianity, as sadomasochistic, barbaric, and repellent. If God wanted to forgive us, why not just forgive us instead of having his son butchered and violently murdered in the process?" Well, you'd expect Richard Dawkins to be down on most Christian doctrines, but it's particularly this idea that Jesus would have to die that he criticizes. In fact, he goes on to say that it legitimizes violence, and he blames all sorts of religious violence over the last 2,000 years on the cross. That's Richard Dawkins. Well, maybe unsurprising. But what about from a Christian teacher? Here are the words of Steve Chalk. He was, well, probably still is, quite a Christian celebrity, the founder of the Oasis Trust and pastor of a church in South London. He says, "The truth is the cross isn't an act of cosmic child abuse, a vengeful father punishing his son for an offense he has not even committed." That's his kind of caricature way of describing the penalty swap. Child abuse. He says, well, of course, we wouldn't want to be associated with anything like that. That was a book a few years ago. He's recently brought out a series of videos in which he says the same thing, came out last year. Or what about in our own denomination, the Church of England, the Bishop of Buckingham a couple of years ago, responding to, you may have seen a Channel 4 documentary about a Christian leader who was involved in abuse of teenage boys, an awful thing. But when he was interviewed about it, the Bishop of Buckingham said, oh, he did this because he believed in this barbaric theology of penal substitution. In other words, here's a bishop saying, child abuse happens because people believe this. It's a pretty horrific allegation. And what they were saying is, come on, give up on this idea of a penalty swap. This is outdated, this is twisted, this is violent. Christians should have nothing to do with it. Well, I haven't got time now to respond to those particular allegations, apart from to say that I think they're really absolutely unfounded. To blame the whole of Christian doctrine for one Christian, or one person claiming to be a Christian, conducting abuse is a terrible sort of piece of political maneuvering. But what I want to do today is to persuade us that the doctrine of penal substitution is actually a wonderful thing, that we should love it and love Jesus for it. It's taught in the Bible, and it is the only hope for our life. I started like that because I want you to be aware that this is something that not everybody believes. It's something that people in churches all over the country are abandoning, and it's something I want us to stand for and to rejoice in and to defend. So we can take it in stages. You'll see the headings on the sheet. And the first heading is a surprising one. The one who gives life must die. The one who gives life must die. If you were here last week, we saw one of the most amazing chapters in the accounts of Jesus' life, where he goes to a funeral of a friend of his called Lazarus, and he empties the tomb. We called the sermon last week, "The Tomb Emptier." And Jesus calls out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" Andrew is getting the children to think about what would happen if you did this in a graveyard ordinarily, and you shout to all these graves, "Come out!" And of course, you look like a bit of an idiot. But when Jesus cries out, "Come out!" the grave opens and the man comes out, looking a bit like the mummy in Scooby-Doo with the grave clothes tied around his face. Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. But in this chapter, we discover that because Jesus raises Lazarus, he himself must die. The one who brings life to others must die. And in fact, John has written his gospel so that we can see that actually this miracle is the trigger for Jesus' own, the plot against Jesus himself to be executed. So that you sort of hints of that even in last week's passage. So if you turn back to chapter 11, verse 7, Jesus is determined to go to Lazarus's grave. And the disciples said to him, verse 8, "Rabbi, the Jews were just now trying to stone you, and you want to go back there?" No, Jesus, do not go to Judea. Much too dangerous. Better to stay quiet, to lay low for a while, to wait for it all to blow over. But instead, Jesus goes into danger, into the place where people are hostile to him, because he wants to go to the funeral. And Thomas is quite pessimistic about this. Verse 16, Thomas called the twin and said to his fellow disciples, "Oh, well, let's go as well then, that we may die with him." So Thomas just sort of suspects things are not going to be so good in Judea. And in fact, on this one occasion, Thomas doesn't always get it right in John's Gospel, but in this one occasion, he is absolutely right. Look at verse 47. "So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, 'What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him.'" They don't want this Jesus movement to get out of control. And to be honest, this is the most successful miracle of all in terms of PR. I mean, you can imagine, can't you? The Jesus movement, they can now put on their advertising, "Our teacher raises the dead." And unsurprisingly, this gets people interested. People start to believe in Jesus. People start to follow Jesus. And his enemies think, this is going to get us nowhere. We better take action. Verse 53, so from that day on they made plans to put him to death. It's the fact that Jesus brought life to Lazarus that causes the Jews, the Jewish leaders, to plan his execution. From life to death. It's a kind of warped logic, isn't it? I mean, somebody around you can raise the dead. Maybe not all of us would think of killing them, but it's really the only way they can stamp it out. In fact, we read at the end of our passage that they decide, verse 10, chapter 12, verse 10, to kill Lazarus as well. So here's Lazarus, exhibit A. He used to be dead, now he's not dead. This is causing a lot of people to become Christians. Let's kill Jesus and let's re-kill Lazarus. Poor guy, has to die twice. But John wants to show us that this isn't just the sort of weird, macabre, vengeful plot of Jesus' enemies. This is also wonderfully the plan of God. The one who gives life must die, but we discover actually the one who gives life must die to give life. It's not just that Lazarus' resurrection causes Jesus' crucifixion, although it does, but Jesus' crucifixion is necessary to all of our resurrection. Lazarus is alive, so Jesus must die, but Jesus must die so that we can be alive. And this insight comes, ironically, from this man called Caiaphas, who doesn't really know what he is saying. Verse 49, one of them, Caiaphas, who was chief high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all." Humble Blake, obviously. "Nor do you understand that it's better for you that one man should die for the people rather than the whole nation perish." Now, it seems that what Caiaphas means is he's a bit worried that if this Jesus movement gathers too much momentum, then the Romans will crack down on the whole Jewish people. And it's not entirely naive to think that. So remember, in the first century, Israel was an occupied country. It was part of the Roman Empire. Roman soldiers marched the streets. You had to pay taxes to the occupying forces, which people hated to do. And occasionally, these soldiers would get violent. We read about an incident in Luke's Gospel where the Roman governor massacred some Jewish worshippers. So things were very tense, a bit like they are in the Middle East right now, but this time with the Jews and the Palestinians in Jerusalem. But easily it could flare up, and there could be executions. And they're worried about this because a whole crowd of thousands of people proclaiming that Jesus is the Messiah, the Romans aren't going to like that. They're going to fear an uprising, and he worries that the whole Jewish people could be wiped out by the Roman soldiers. So it seems like just a political suggestion. It'd be better if Jesus died than all of us get killed. That's what he's saying. But, verse 51, he didn't say this on his own. But being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. Now, what John is saying here, John the narrator stepping in and saying, I know Caiaphas is just being political, but actually, without even realizing it, he is a prophet. God has put some true words into his mouth. Now, this happens a few times in the Bible where people speak on God's behalf without really knowing what they're saying. And the most famous one is when a donkey opens its mouth in the book of Numbers and speaks truth to a guy called Balaam. And it's a little bit like this here. I mean, Caiaphas isn't literally a donkey, but I don't think he really gets the full significance of what he's saying. But God is giving him this prophecy. And he's actually saying something much more profound than he realizes. It's better, he says, that one man should die for the people than that the whole nation should perish. Now, we don't always do geeky New Testament Greek in sermons because we've got English translations. Most of us speak English. Not many of us speak ancient Greek. And so try and keep that kind of thing to a minimum. But today I just want to go into the meaning of one Greek word, and it's the word for in verse 51. He prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and the Greek word I've put on the sheet is the word hyper or hooper, and it means literally instead of. Caiaphas says it's better that one man should die instead of the people. In other words, a swap. He uses the Greek word that means a swap. Better that Jesus died and that we don't die. And he's locked on to a big theme in Jesus' own teaching that we haven't noticed so far, but I want to, with hindsight, just turn back some chapters we've looked at earlier this year and just see it again and again. So just turn back to John chapter 6. John chapter 6, verse 49. Jesus has just said, I'm the bread of life. It's just after he's fed the 5,000. And this is how he explains it. Verse 49, chapter 6. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and they died. This is the bread that comes down from heaven, that one may eat of it and not die. You see, so it's from death to life, from dying to not dying. How do you go from dying to not dying? Well, this is the bread that comes down from heaven, that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. So Jesus is saying in chapter 6, a bit like he said in chapter 11, I can give you eternal life. Chapter 6, he proves it by feeding a huge crowd with miraculously with a few bread rolls. Chapter 11, he proves it by raising this dead man Lazarus from the dead in front of witnesses. But listen in chapter 6 to the explanation. And the bread that I will give, hooper, for, instead of, that same Greek word again, the bread I'll give instead of the life of the world is my flesh. So Jesus is saying there, I'm going to bring life because I'm going to die instead. My flesh instead of your flesh. My death instead of your death. And that's how I will bring life to you. It's there in chapter 6. And it's there in chapter 10. We were just there a few weeks ago. Just turn over to chapter 10. Jesus describing himself as a good shepherd. And chapter 10, verse 11, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for, it's the same Greek word again, hooper, instead of the sheep. The shepherd's going to die, and the sheep are not going to die. They're going to live. And then we get to our own chapter. And Caiaphas, without realizing it, as a prophet, prophesies the same thing. Better that one man should die instead of the people. And this is so significant that John actually repeats it just before the crucifixion. And in chapter 18, he reminds us of the prophecy. Chapter 18, verse 12, the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. They led him to Annas. Annas was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that day, that year. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews it would be expedient that one man should die instead of, hooper, the people. See, it comes again and again and again in John's Gospel. Jesus is the one who brings life, who can feed 5,000 people, who can open the eyes of a blind man, who can raise a man, Lazarus, from the dead. But the only reason that he can bring life is because he himself will give his life instead of ours. In other words, this doctrine of penal substitution, you can understand the atheist hating it. Richard Dawkins, I guess, doesn't even believe in life after death, does he? He just thinks that when you die, you decompose, and that's it. He doesn't believe in the resurrection, and he dismisses all the evidence for Jesus raising the dead. But it is a shocking thing to find bishops and church leaders denying this, because it is taught again and again and again by Jesus himself, and by the New Testament writers. His life for our life. Penal substitution. But I want us to see today that isn't just a doctrine that we understand, that we can defend. It's actually a reason to love Jesus very, very much. Not just a dry academic thing, It is an amazing, amazing thing. Let's look again at chapter 12. Mary took a pound of expensive ointment made from pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. I imagine it's a bit like that shop Lush. You know, as you walk down the high street and you can be about 500 yards away from it and you still get knocked out by the aroma of the wall of perfume. But we're not talking sort of cheap Lush blocks of bright green or bright pink soap. We're talking the kind of perfume that I guess only a few of the ladies here have been given as presents on very, very special days. We're not talking eau de toilette, which is the only kind of perfume I've ever bought my mum, I confess, which is the sort of watered-down one. We're talking the actual French perfume one. And the reason most of us don't get that is it is very, very, very expensive. A little tiny bottle of actual perfume, even today's price, would be about 100 quid, I guess, maybe more. This isn't just a little bottle of it. This is a pound of it. And if you want to get a feel for just how extravagant that is, Judas Iscariot helps you out by pricing it for you. Chapter 12, verse 5. Why was this not sold for 300 denarii? One denarius was a day's wage for a laborer. So 300 denarii is almost a year's wage for a laborer. The average wage in London at the moment is about £34,000. Made me feel quite poor, but that's the average. But I guess a laborer, sort of a minimum wage, would be about 20-something thousand pounds. That's quite a lot of perfume. And she pours it all out and starts to wipe Jesus' feet with her. No wonder you can smell it 100 yards away, the house full of the fragrance of the perfume. And I don't know how you feel about that. It just seems a little bit extravagant, doesn't it? I mean, to blow 20-something thousand quid in 1 hour's gesture to say, I love you, seems extravagant. I mean, it would be like buying a car, tying ribbons around it and pushing it off a cliff, videoing it on your phone, and then posting the video to a friend saying, this is how much I love you. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just gone in a moment. 20 grand just to say how much I care. Or taking out 20 grand in 50 pound notes and then setting fire to them just because your loved one was a little bit chilly. And you want to, I mean, it's just there are cheaper ways to say I love you than this, aren't there? I mean, this is a lot of cash blown in a very extravagant gesture. But she doesn't hesitate to do it because she loves Jesus. Actually, the complaint about wastefulness comes from, John reminds us, a thief, actually. So don't take Judas's remarks about selling it to give to the poor too seriously. He actually just wants his hand in the till and would quite like some of that cash for himself. Why is it that Mary loves Jesus so, so much? Well, first reason, because he's just raised her brother from the dead. And you'll see there in verse 1, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus has raised from the dead, just to remind us. So they gave a dinner for him there. Verse 3, Mary therefore took the ointment and anointed his feet. One of the principles that we're learning in Wednesday nights for understanding the Bible is whenever you see the word therefore in the Bible, you ask what it's there for. And this therefore tells us why she blows all this perfume. Because her brother used to be dead and now he's alive. So they held the dinner. I mean, I'm not surprised, are you? I mean, it's the very least you do. Jesus, we ought to have you around for dinner sometime, you know, just to say thank you, you know, for raising him from the dead and everything. I mean, he owes his entire life to Jesus. So of course they have a celebration. And of course she blows all the perfume. Who wouldn't love somebody that gave them life when otherwise they would be dead? I guess it's the way people might feel towards their surgeon or their oncologist if the treatment goes well. You'd be very, very grateful. But this is more than that, isn't it? Because this is eternal life that Jesus can offer. Christians ought to love him for giving eternal life. But there is another reason, and it's there in verse 7. I want you to look at the footnote for, I think, a better translation. Jesus says, "Leave her alone. She intended to keep it for the day of my burial." Literally, leave her alone for the day of my burial. This action of hers was for the day of my burial. In other words, she is honoring Jesus with all this perfume, not just because he could bring life, but because he is going to die to bring life. It's not just the amazing gift he gives us, but it's the amazing cost to Jesus to get it. She's giving him 20 grand worth of perfume. It cost Jesus a lot more than that to give us life. See, the doctrine of penal substitution, the penalty swap, Jesus instead of us, he dies so that we might live, it ought to make Christians love him twice over. Love him because we have life, but love him because it cost him his life to give us life. It makes me very sad when a bishop attacks this, or when a famous Christian teacher describes it as child abuse, you know, as if Jesus had no say in it. Jesus absolutely, deliberately and willingly going to his death, not just his father's plan, but his plan. And actually, it's quite chilling, isn't it? Because there's a sort of choice of responses in chapter 12 to this truth. You've got Mary, or you've got Judas. Which is your response? Do you love Jesus extravagantly, lavishly, because he gives life? Or do you criticize her, and actually it's out of a sort of self-interest and a rather ugly thing? See, it's penal substitution, this doctrine, that really divides people, not into the doctrinally correct and the doctrinally incorrect. It's not just a sort of precise mathematical who gets the best mark in their theology paper kind of thing. Now, penal substitution divides people into those who love Jesus and those who love themselves in a kind of cynical and sniping, co-oping, criticizing kind of way. And so I want to say to us today as we gather, do you see this is a precious truth? But do you love Jesus for it? Jesus, he's the one who gave me life. He is the reason I'm going to be alive in 1,000 years' time. And it cost him everything to give me life. I love him. And actually, your year's wages would be a very small token of gratitude, wouldn't it? A life lived in service for him, a very small payment. In that wonderful hymn, "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross," if I had everything in the whole of nature to give him, that would be too small. Certainly my devotion, my love, my obedience, my praise. We'll take a moment's pause, and then we're going to pray together.